Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start with some short ones today. They may be short, but they're well worth hearing. This is all from Forbes Daily, and the date of this particular newsletter is April 30th. Here's the first one. A large chunk of Silicon Valley's AI build-out is tied to the success of OpenAI, including CoreWeave, an AI cloud company which counts the ChatGPT maker as one of its biggest customers. So, with OpenAI CFO Sarah Friar expressing concern that the company may not be able to pay future computing contracts, it could be especially devastating for CoreWeave. CoreWeave insists it can ride out turbulence as long as demand continues to exceed supply across the AI ecosystem. But that trillion-dollar ecosystem itself is concentrated in a very few places. Now, here are three very quick ones in a row. Number one, the Federal Reserve kept interest rates steady in Jerome Powell's final meeting as chair, though Powell said he would stay on as a central bank governor amid a series of legal attacks facing the institution. Next point, Bill Ackman's hedge fund, Pershing Square, got off to an uneven start in its IPO, with shares of its closed-end fund trading roughly 16% below their target price last Wednesday. Final short point, global oil prices surged to their highest level since the start of the U.S.-Iran war early Thursday morning, as President Donald Trump is reportedly scheduled to receive a briefing on new plans for potential military action later today. Now here's a story about AI music and the potential implications. Again, from Forbes, dated April 30th. Inside Suno's $2.5 billion bet that AI made music is here to stay. More than 100 million people have now used startup Suno's AI music generation software. Suno-created songs have gone viral on TikTok, debuted on Billboard charts, and racked up millions of streams. Over 7 million songs are made on the app every day, catapulting it to the top of the Apple App Store's most downloaded music apps in April, surpassing Spotify. The technology finally allows for billions of people to be creative, to have the fruits of their labor, to feel fulfillment in different ways, says CEO Mikey Shulman. But that's come at the cost of professional musicians. In its early days, Suno admitted that its AI has been trained on tens of millions of songs from the internet, including copyrighted recordings, triggering fierce backlash. In 2024, some 200 musicians called out AI companies for training their models on artists' work without their permission. In July 2024, Universal Music Group, Sony Music, Warner Music Group, and the Recording Industry Association of America hit Suno with a massive lawsuit. The companies fought back, and Shulman says Suno is simply leveling the playing field. But the music industry's griping hasn't stopped the four-year-old startup from becoming a smash hit success. The company's annualized revenue tripled from $100 million in October to $300 million in February. In 2025, its revenue was about $150 million, Forbes estimates. While Suno might be fun for aspiring songwriters and people who want to make a customized song for their mom's birthday, does anyone actually want to listen to AI music? Is it even good? And what does AI slopification mean for the human artists struggling to make it in an increasingly saturated music industry? Asked Forbes staff writer Rashi Srivastava. These are existential questions, both for Suno and the industry itself. Luckily for human artists, fully Suno-generated tracks sound like something you might hear on the radio and forget as soon as they're finished. As one industry executive puts it, music is the language of emotion. Are you going to want a robot to tell you what it's like to get over a broken heart? Now we're going back to longer format stories, and the first one, this should surprise no one, is about SpaceX and Elon Musk. Here's the title of the article. It's from Forbes magazine. SpaceX's IPO could leave Tesla eating rocket dust. Tesla's biggest problem may no longer be Chinese competitors, slowing demand for its EVs on the still theoretical payoff for robotics or humanoid robots. Its biggest problem might be SpaceX. If Elon Musk's rocket and satellite internet company goes public at anything close to the rumored $1.75 trillion valuation, yes, I said trillion, it will be not just one of the biggest IPOs in history. It'll give Tesla investors tired of waiting for the CEO's promises to materialize something they haven't had in a while, a potentially bigger, more exciting way to invest in the Musk myth. Certainly, SpaceX, with its reliable and steady leadership under longtime President Gwynne Shotwell, is shaping up to be a shinier proxy, with few close competitors or awkward quarterly questions about exactly when Tesla can take on Waymo in self-driving tech or actually deliver its C-3PO-style robot. There are many Tesla investors who perceive SpaceX to be a better investment for many reasons. Ross Gerber, a Tesla investor and CEO of Santa Monica, California-based Gerber Kawasaki, which manages over $4 billion, told Forbes, "If I sell my Tesla shares, nobody's going to argue that it's not overvalued. And if I want to buy the sizzle, I'm going to buy SpaceX." And that's what people want to do a lot. A lot of people think this is going to be easy money. That's largely because despite Tesla's continued profitability, it's undergoing a fundamental shift from the business that built the brand, electrical vehicle sales, which have plateaued as it waits for its new AI-oriented ones to kick in. That was underscored this week with the Austin-based company's first quarter results. Net income rose to $477 million, up 16% from a year ago, when the brand was stung by anti-Musk protests and reduced Model Y SUV production as it shifted to an updated version. But that's far below profit in the three previous quarters, including $844 million in 2025's final 3 months. The company's battery business, a bright spot last year, contracted in the first quarter, down 12%. Overall revenue rose 16% to $22.4 billion, but that was also below the level of the past three quarters. What we're seeing with Tesla is a brand where belief is doing more work than strategy, and the real test is how long can that dynamic continue to hold? Tesla didn't report any revenue from its tiny robotic fleet, which operates mainly in Texas, with human safety drivers at the wheel. Likewise, it had no revenue from Optimus robots in the quarter, another hoped-for revenue stream, as they're not yet in production. However, the company is planning to spend at least $25 billion to turn Musk's AI and robotic dreams into reality. Its shares fell 3.6% to $373.72 on Thursday. They're down about 17% this year. What we're seeing with Tesla is a brand where belief is doing more work than strategy. Gonzalo Brujo, CEO of Interbrand, which compiles an annual ranking of the appeal of global brands, told Forbes, "Tesla's brand value plunged 35% in 2025, due in large part to Musk's unpopularity, arising from his Doge role in the Trump administration and support of far-right European politicians. The brand lost momentum as its leadership became a source of distraction rather than differentiation. With Musk now less dominant in the public conversation, some of that pressure has eased, but it hasn't sparked a comeback. It's simply getting things worse," Brujo said. SpaceX, in some way, could be a carbon copy of what happened with Tesla after its 2010 IPO, said Dan Coatsworth, head of markets for UK-based investment advisor AJ Bell, which doesn't rate either company. Tesla had a first-mover advantage with electric vehicles. It made a really good name for itself, and shareholders made a lot of money. Now, the competition is catching up, overtaking it arguably in certain areas, he said. It might be that someone who's been in Tesla for ages might say, well, I've made my money, and what SpaceX is doing is trying to get a first-mover advantage in the space economy, and the gap between itself and its rivals is so big at the moment. Musk's success in creating the modern EV market, Tesla's growth since the release of its Model S sedan in 2012, and his persistent claims of technical wonders that are just around the corner helped the stock trade at nearly 200 times projected earnings. Likewise, the Musk effect is why its market cap is 12 times the company's estimated revenue this year of about $100 billion. Compared with SpaceX, however, that looks conservative. The rocket company's projected $1.75 trillion IPO valuation is about 80 times its estimated revenue of $22 billion this year, mainly from the Starlink internet business. And while new businesses like the space-based data centers Musk has promised sound exciting, they may not be viable anytime soon. Our initiatives to develop orbital AI compute and in-orbit lunar and interplanetary industrialization are in early stages. They involve significant technical complexity and unproven technologies and may not achieve commercial viability, according to an excerpt of its S-1 filing seen by Reuters. Musk's large fan base among retail investors has spurred excitement for the SpaceX IPO, but Morningstar analyst Seth Goldstein, who thinks Tesla shares are fairly valued at the current level, didn't see that as a negative for Tesla. I don't necessarily see it as people trading out of Tesla for SpaceX, he said. I think from an institutional standpoint, we're likely to see maybe some Tesla shares, but also other positions trimmed, likely to make room for SpaceX in the portfolio. Likewise, Ben Callow, a senior research analyst for Baird, who's covered Tesla since the company's IPO, and has an outperform rating on the shares, expects only a minority of investors to swap Musk stocks. I think there'll be some individual investors that raise cash from Tesla share sales to buy SpaceX, but I think the larger trend will be private investors holding both Tesla and SpaceX. The individual investor expands investment in the overall Elon complex, he says. Our view is that ultimately the companies are likely merged for many reasons. He's not alone in the expectations that ultimately the companies will be combined, something that's been expected for well over a decade. But that possibility raises a concern for some large institutional investors that hold Tesla and will also have a position in SpaceX, resulting from past investments in the former Twitter and XAI, which Musk is wrapping into the offering. Board independence and the ability to maintain guardrails for the often controversial Musk. The reality is that the governance issues that we're seeing at Tesla and a formal relationship between Tesla and SpaceX means that the same governance issues will continue at SpaceX. A board member of a public fund that holds Tesla and will almost certainly buy SpaceX post-IPO told Forbes, speaking on background as it's against the fund's policy to comment on specific investments, the person was most concerned about material risk stemming from a history of governance issues in the XAI part of SpaceX. Gerber, whose investment firm will hold SpaceX shares through past investments in former Twitter and XAI, which are wrapped into the offering, also expects an eventual combination of the Musk companies, and problems until they do. You can't really run two public companies and not have conflict of interest lawsuits constantly, especially with companies that sell each other products. And because XAI, Musk's artificial intelligence company, is wrapped into SpaceX, you've got the brains of Tesla and Grok and Optimus all run by SpaceX, That doesn't make a lot of sense. It never did, he said. They have to come together. And if SpaceX IPOs before they come together, it's messy when they do come together. For now, Gerber expects more near-term excitement from SpaceX. It's a better meme stock because you can't quantify space. If you're going to be a meme stock, you want to be in an industry that you can't really quantify. We're going to change industries completely now. We're going from SpaceX to one of the biggest pop stars of all times, Michael Jackson. The article's from Forbes magazine, dated April 30th, by Matt Craig. Title of the article is, How Much the Michael Jackson Estate Could Earn on the New Biopic. The Berlin world premiere of Michael, the new Anton Fuqua-directed biopic, starring Michael Jackson's nephew Jafar in the title role, saw thousands of King of Pop fans gather outside the theater. Rapturous applause after each of the movie's musical numbers, and fawning praise over the lead performance. Left out of the celebratory film and tightly controlled red carpet rollout was any mention of the sexual abuse accusations that complicate his legacy. Yet producer Graham King admitted to being nervous and anxious to see the film with audiences for the first time. A lot has happened on this film that I question how and why, said King, who also produced the Queen biopic Bohemian Rhapsody. I used to say to Freddie Mercury was throwing hurdles down at me. Michael did the same. So Michael and Freddie are up there together, laughing right now. With an initial $150 million budget, Michael was already the most ambitious biopic of all time when it wrapped initial production in May 2024. That was before the estate's executors learned of a clause in a 1994 settlement with one of the Jacksons' child molestation accusers, agreeing to never dramatize their story on screen, rendering a significant amount of footage useless. Instead of a 3.5-hour epic, Lionsgate and the filmmakers decided to end the movie in the late 1980s, at the height of Jackson's career following Thriller and Bad, and the estate agreed to fund 22 days of additional production at a cost Forbes estimates to be more than $25 million. Some reports put it as high as $50 million. Now, Michael needs to gross more than $500 million globally to be profitable, and here's a quick aside. In its first weekend of release, Michael grossed $238 million. Now back to the article. A mark only ever reached by one other movie in the genre, Bohemian Rhapsody, and Lionsgate is reportedly hoping for more than $700 million, including downstream revenue from streaming, etc., in order to greenlight a sequel, which would cover the second half of Jackson's life using some of the existing footage. As a co-investor in the movie, the Jackson estate could be on the hook for millions if it doesn't break even, but as an equity partner, is also in a position to earn more if Michael turns into a Bohemian-sized blockbuster, passing $900 million globally in 2018. In addition to an estimated $10 million the estate earned up front for co-producing and licensing the movie, its estimated 25% profit participation could return more than $40 million on top of the initial investment in the best-case scenario. That's not including expected sales bumps to Jackson's music catalog, a Cirque du Soleil show based on his life in Las Vegas, stage musicals on Broadway and across the world, and other ancillary businesses that earned the estate an estimated $105 million in 2025. And as a result, the 2026 total will likely be much higher. Box office analysts are optimistic about Michael, perhaps even more so in its new controversy-free and music-focused form. It's projected to earn more than $65 million domestically in its opening weekend, topping Bohemian Rhapsody, $51 million, and 2015's Straight Out of Compton, $60 million, for the most ever by a music biopic, not adjusted for inflation. That suggests a cumulative total of potentially more than $200 million in North America alone. The Jackson estate has already seen the effect a hit movie can have on its fortunes. At the time of his death in June 2009 from a lethal injection, the 50-year-old King of Pop was on the brink of financial peril, with at least $450 million in debt, including $40 million to concert promoter AEG Live in advances and costs for a tour he could no longer execute, and a reputation mired by controversy and legal troubles. He was an extremely valuable asset, but he was hemorrhaging cash, says L. London McMillan, an attorney, who worked with Jackson from 2005 until his death. Had we not refinanced and restructured those loans, he would have lost it all. Shortly before his death, a small team that included the co-executor of Jackson's estate, John Branca, his manager, Frank DeLeo, accountant Michael Caine, and then AEG Live CEO Randy Phillips, agreed to discuss how to make as much money from whatever assets the estates had, according to court documents. They hatched an idea to make a documentary out of the concert rehearsal footage as he prepared for a new tour shortly before his death. And in October 2009, Michael Jackson's This Is It rode a wave of posthumous love and support to more than $265 million at the global box office and an additional $100 million-plus in DVDs, soundtrack, and merchandise sales. The estimated $200 million earned by the estate on the film not only saved its financial future, it kick-started the most lucrative stretch of Jackson's career. True to his original promise, Branca has maximized profits by selling off the considerable assets Jackson accumulated during his life, including his Neverland Ranch to billionaire Ron Burkle in 2020 for $22 million, the 4,000-song ATV catalog to Sony Music in 2016 for $750 million, and half of Jackson's own musical rights to Sony in 2024 for $600 million, and by commercially exploiting his enduring popularity across many different mediums, including new albums of unreleased music, touring shows, stage productions, and now a major Hollywood biopic. Since Jackson's death, Forbes estimates the estate has earned more than $3.5 billion, achieved the number one spot on our annual list of highest paid dead celebrities in 13 of the last 16 years. A significant amount of that money has gone to taxes, paying off Jackson's debts, and dealing with the near constant legal challenges, beginning with the validity of Jackson's 2002 will, naming Branca and music executive John McClain as co-executors and co-trustees of the estate, leaving 20% of his fortune to charity, with the rest split between his mother and three children, cutting out other family members. Even the beneficiaries have brought complaints. In 2024, Jackson's mother, Catherine, fought the sale of his musical catalog in court unsuccessfully, and his daughter, Paris, currently has an ongoing lawsuit against the executors over how much they spent on the movie, an investment that she called highly speculative and risky. She claims that they have enriched themselves with nearly $150 million in compensation and used their status as producers to cast movie stars to play them in the film. Miles Teller played Branca in Michael. The executors counter by saying Paris has a complete lack of understanding about how the motion picture industry works and cites $65 million in benefits already paid out to her, a figure she denies. While Jackson's two other children, BG and Prince, appeared at the Michael premiere in support of the film, Paris has continued to oppose it publicly. The thing about the biopics is, it's Hollywood, it's fantasy land. It's not real, but it's sold to you as real, she posted on Instagram in September. The narrative is being controlled, and there's a lot of inaccuracy, and there's a lot of just full-blown lies, At the end of the day, that just doesn't really fly with me. In the past decade, more than a dozen artists have brought their stories to the big screen, including Elvis, Elton John, Bob Marley, and Bob Dylan. These movies don't always lead to massive paydays, as the standard deal for an artist is believed to be 1 to 3 million up front and 5 to 10% of back-end net profits. In the modest success of 100 to 300 million globally, movie earnings for artists are likely to be in the single-digit millions, but it is a valuable brand-building exercise. It definitely makes a long-term difference, says Tim Hegarty, head of M&A at Cutting Edge Group, owner of one of the biggest catalogs of movie music in the world. If you have a film that makes more than $100 million at the box office, that is a sustainable new income stream you can rely on for a long time. In 2019, the Jackson Estate struck a deal with King to go produce its movie, hoping to replicate the outlier success that he had with Bohemian Rhapsody. That movie also sidestepped aspects of Mercury's life, most notably his sexuality, in favor of extended concert scenes celebrating Queen's music. It was a strategy that worked particularly well overseas, where the movie made nearly $700 million of its $900 million total. Similarly, the This Is It concert film earned $195 million of its $268 million total internationally, which explains why, not coincidentally, the estate negotiated a far larger share of international royalties. Music is the international language, says Paul Digger Bedarian, senior media analyst at Comscore, and international is where they get that return on investment. For surviving Queen band members and the Mercury estate, profit participation in the movie, which had a reported production budget of just $55 million, and its marketing bump across other businesses, was transformational. According to UK public filings, the band's holding company saw revenue increase from roughly $24 million in 2017, before the movie's release, to $94 million in 2019, and it paid dividends to band members of more than $85 million across the next 4 years. Revenue remained at an elevated level when the band sold its catalog and publishing in 2024 to Sony Music for more than $1.2 billion. The ultimate boom case is that you've made them so culturally relevant again that it has a long-standing effect on the revenue rather than a spike, says Hegarty. You've actually created a cultural moment for a new generation, and appealing to fans who were born after Jackson's death might lead to both box office success and ensuring that the $100 million per year business thrives for years to come. If you can crack the code on how to get Gen Z excited about these musical artists, that's really key, says Durgar Abedian. This is like a 2-hour infomercial for everything Michael Jackson. Next, we're going to talk about a very surprising develop of the Iranian conflict. This is from Fortune magazine, dated April 28th, written by Nick Lichtenberg. OPEC shocker as UAE leaves oil cartel days after negotiating swap lines with Scott Bessent's treasury. The United Arab Emirates stunned the already reeling global energy markets Tuesday by announcing it is quitting both OPEC and OPEC Plus, dealing a heavy blow to the oil exporters cartel and its de facto leader, Saudi Arabia, and doing so just days after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent publicly backed an emergency dollar swap line for Abu Dhabi before the U.S. Senate. OPEC has absorbed departures before. Qatar left at the beginning of 2019, but Qatar produces almost entirely natural gas rather than oil, so its exit didn't meaningfully alter the group's clout. Angola left 2 years ago, citing production quota disputes, but Angola's output was modest enough that the markets barely flinched. The UAE is categorically different. Along with Iran, the UAE is OPEC's most significant producer after Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and critically, the Saudis and the UAE have been growing increasingly at odds, even before the current war, with disputes over production baselines, regional politics, and strategic direction that stretch back years. The loss of the UAE is the single biggest defection in OPEC's history. UAE Central Bank Governor Khaled Mohammed Balama traveled to Washington during the IMF and World Bank spring meetings to meet with Besant and Federal Reserve representatives officially to align perspectives on current financial priorities and to explore innovative solutions that support the stability of the regional financial system. The concept of the swap line has taken on added importance to world central banking since the great financial crisis of 2008, as financial historian Adam Tooze argued in his account of the crisis, crashed, with the Treasury and Federal Reserve pumping liquidity into a system that was on life support. More recently, Besant extended a $20 billion swap line to Argentina among market reverse volatility ahead of a pivotal election, which he said was fully repaid within months. Besant defended the UAE arrangement before Senate Appropriations Subcommittee without naming the UAE directly. A few days earlier, White House NEC Director Kevin Hassett reinforced the message, calling the UAE an incredibly valuable ally and pledging Treasury would make every effort to assist, while saying swap lines probably would not be required. The UAE floated the possibility of pricing some oil transactions in Chinese yuan if dollar liquidity tightened, a scenario that would have accelerated the erosion of dollar dominance in global energy markets. Opinions vary about the fragility of the so-called petrodollar system that was in place for a whopping 50 years, from 1974 until 2024. And only recently revealed by a Bloomberg FOIA request in 2016. But there can be no doubt that Washington has moved quickly in a highly fluid situation involving energy and currency flows. The political backdrop is a UAE that has spent months absorbing Iranian missile strikes largely alone. UAE diplomatic advisor Anwan Gargash made that frustration explicit at the Gulf Influencers Forum on Monday, just hours before the OPEC announcement. The Gulf Cooperation Council countries supported each other logistically, but politically and militarily, I think their position has been the weakest historically, he said. I expect this weak stance from the Arab League, and I'm not surprised by it. But I haven't expected it from the Cooperation Council, and I am surprised by that. Washington's response has been markedly different. Secretary of State Marco Rubio held direct security talks with UAE Foreign Minister Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan as recently as April 26th. Israel, at U.S. encouragement, deployed its Iron Dome missile defense to UAE soil, operated by IDF personnel, believed to be the first time Iron Dome has ever been deployed in a foreign country during an active conflict. The U.S. has also rapidly expanded its military footprint at Al Dhafra Air Base in Abu Dhabi. The UAE has additionally demanded that any U.S.-Iran settlement explicitly guarantee freedom of navigation through the Strait of Hormuz, effectively giving Abu Dhabi a veto condition over ceasefire negotiations. The OPEC exit lands on top of a petrodollar system that was already fraying at its edges. As Fortune reported in April, the dollar share of global foreign exchange reserves has fallen to roughly 57%, a 25-year low, down from a peak of 72% in 2001. Ships passing through Hormuz have at times paid tolls to Iran in Bitcoin. Iran sells an increasing share of its oil to China in yuan, and India may now be buying Iranian oil in yuan as well. Deutsche Bank economists have warned that the conflict is strengthening Iran-China ties and could be remembered as a key catalyst for erosion in petrodollar dominance and the beginnings of the petro-yuan. Washington seems to have calculated that the UAE cannot join this brewing new regime, although economists urge caution about overstating what the UAE's exit means for the dollar. As Paul Bluestein of CSIS has argued, the Saudis chose the dollar in 1970s, not because of a secret deal, but because of the reality also known as TINA, or there is no alternative, with the depth and liquidity of U.S. financial markets leaving Gulf petrostates little practical choice. The GCC sovereign wealth funds still hold more than $2 trillion invested in U.S. assets, and Gulf currencies remain pegged to the dollar, requiring an estimated $800 billion in supporting reserves. I'm not going to say that the petrodollar is dead, because that's wrong, Fidel Kaboub, an associate professor of economics at Denison University, previously told Fortune. It is still overwhelmingly the dominant currency in international transactions. The rupture within OPEC also lands on top of years of accumulated economic grievance. ADNOC has expanded production capacity to target 5 million barrels per day by 2027, well beyond the quota OPEC had assigned to Abu Dhabi. Baker Institute researchers estimated in 2023 that unconstrained production could generate the UAE upward of $50 billion in additional annual revenues. President Trump, who has long accused OPEC of ripping off the rest of the world and explicitly linked U.S. military protection of Gulf states to oil pricing behavior, now has his most tangible win yet against the cartel. The UAE would have to wait for the Straits of Hormuz to safely reopen. Of course, to reap the full benefits of this, the UAE risks undermining its own ability to impact global markets as the international influence of the Saudi-dominated OPEC wanes. In the previous decade, OPEC was boosted by the inclusion of unofficial members, especially Russia, as the so-called OPEC Plus group. But since early 2020, the Saudis and Russians have found themselves more at odds over issues including the war in Ukraine and Russia's close relationship with Iran. The consequences for global energy markets are immediate and severe. Brent crude has already surged past $100 per barrel as Iranian threats strangle Hormuz. The checkpoint through which roughly 20% of global crude and LNG normally passes. A UAE free to pump at will could eventually inject meaningful new supply, but that relief is months away. In the near term, OPEC's ability to present a united front in one of the worst energy crises in decades has collapsed. The UAE has signaled it expects any U.S.-Iran peace settlement to explicitly guarantee freedom of navigation through Hormuz, effectively inserting itself as a veto player in ceasefire negotiations. Abu Dhabi is no longer just an OPEC member or Gulf ally. It is a full partner in Washington's regional strategy, with all the leverage that entails. Change of pace coming up here. Let's do a hypothetical. Suppose you're very wealthy. You have lots of extremely valuable assets, but not much cash, and you need some cash. Where do you go as a very rich person to raise cash quickly? Here's a possibility. This article is from Forbes magazine by Sergey Klebnikov, dated April 20th. Title of the article is Inside the Pawn Shop for the Ultra Rich. Inside a climate-controlled room at Lender Luxury Asset Capital's Manhattan office, rows of Hermès handbags line the shelves. Minnie Kellys in exotic skins worth roughly $75,000 each. Diamond-encrusted Birkin bags and other limited-edition pieces that are worth six figures. Nearby, a first edition of The Catcher in the Rye, which can sell for as much as $50,000, sits alongside contemporary artwork, including a Yoshito Nara drawing worth more than $200,000. Down the hall, safes hold scores of Rolex watches, diamonds, and gold jewelry, all meticulously tagged and sealed, and none of it is for sale. These items are all collateral, pledged by ultra-wealthy borrowers seeking quick cash. Denver-based Luxury Asset Capital runs its operation with the basic mechanics of a neighborhood pawn shop and the discretion of a Swiss bank. Borrowers pledge their watches, jewelry, handbags, and fine art in exchange for short-term, non-recourse loans, often funded within a single day. One borrower who manages a large hedge fund hocked his wife's 8-carat diamond ring worth upwards of $600,000 after receiving a large margin call. The loan was ultimately repaid and the ring was in turn returned. Another client once brought in an Emmy Award as collateral. Luxury asset lending sits at the intersection of wealth management and urgency. Cash poor but asset rich borrowers pledge high-end possessions in exchange for fast cash, rather than selling them outright or navigating the paperwork and personal guarantees of traditional bank loans. It's amazing how many people come to us and say, "I didn't know I could do this," says Dewey Burke, founder and CEO of Luxury Asset Capital. Started in 2016, the firm reached profitability within its first year, and over the last decade has lent well north of $1 billion across his portfolio of brands, most notably Boro, the company's online lending platform, as well as physical locations in New York, Palm Beach, and Beverly Hills. Revenue was estimated at $65 million last year. Clients who use luxury assets as a revolving line of credit range from entrepreneurs and investors to collectors and business owners. Some arrive with safes full of watches. Others ship handbags overnight. A growing number treat their possessions as working capital. One of our watch clients is constantly on wait lists at Rolex and Patek. Burke adds, they'll come in, take a loan on one watch, go buy the new one, and just cycle through. Flexibility is a big part of the appeal. While traditional banks typically lend against security portfolios or real estate, luxury asset lenders are willing to finance a broader range of items that stretch the bounds of alternative assets for traditional financial institutions. Boro has loaned money against everything from Super Bowl rings to samurai swords to a midtown Manhattan parking space. The pitch is simple: speed, discretion, and no personal guarantees. Borrowers pledge their luxurious collateral, receive funds quickly, and redeem their assets later. If they don't repay, the lender keeps the item and sells it, often through auction houses like Christie's or Sotheby's. In the past decade, handbags have emerged as one of the fastest-growing categories. Hermès, Birkin, and Kelly bags, particularly in exotic or custom versions, routinely fetch hundreds of thousands of dollars on the secondary market. One of Burroughs' clients in Beverly Hills once used the service to borrow roughly $30,000 against a custom Hermès Mini Birkin she had commissioned after waiting nearly a year for it to be produced. She had paid about $33,000 for the piece and had been offered more than $50,000 on the secondary market, but wanted to hold on to it. "I didn't want to sell it," she says. Owning an Hermès bag is not an opportunity that comes round every day. Instead, she used the loan to help finance renovations on a property she planned to flip. "It gave me a bridge loan to get the other side," she adds. Another business owner based in London says she had repeatedly borrowed against diamond-encrusted Birkins and Van Cleef & Arpels jewelry to help finance her businesses. In one instance, she shipped items overnight and received funds within hours. "These are diamond Birkin bags sitting in my closet," she says. "It gives me the opportunity to generate revenue instead of letting assets sit unused." Luxury asset collateral lending is not new, of course. In the 14th century, the Medici family pioneered modern banking practices in Florence for wealthy customers and simultaneously operated pawn shops at the low end. Today, it is increasingly marketed as a white-glove alternative to traditional pawn shops and private banks. Burke says the thesis for the business model was straightforward: provide a reliable loan alternative to banks, who traditionally don't know how to value luxury assets. Banks are kind of famous for saying, "We don't know what we don't know." He says, if it's not real estate or marketable securities, we're just going to write that down to zero. Another appealing incentive is that these loans are non-recourse. If the borrower fails to repay, the firm keeps and sells the item. There are no credit checks, no income verification, and payouts often happen the same day. Luxury Asset Capital now operates offices in Denver, New York, Los Angeles, and Florida, and thanks to Boro, has clients in all 50 states. Burke says the firm's loan book has grown roughly 25-fold over the past decade, though he declined to disclose revenue figures. Typical loans average between $15,000 and $20,000, though Boro can lend up to $5 million. Those loans can be lucrative for lenders, most are short-term, typically lasting 30 to 120 days, though many borrowers extend or renew them, effectively using luxury assets as revolving lines of credit. Boro typically charges interest in the low single digits per month, according to Burke, with additional costs such as insurance and storage. In some cases, that can bring total borrowing costs to around 5% monthly for short-term loans. At that level, borrowers could face annualized rates approaching 60%. But because loans are often measured in months rather than in years, borrowers view the cost as a trade-off for speed and flexibility. For lenders, however, the math can add up quickly, particularly given repeat borrowing rates of roughly 74%. Loan-to-value ratios typically range from roughly 40% to 65%, depending on the asset. According to Burke, higher for more liquid categories like Rolex watches and lower for more specialized assets. That's on par with private institutions like Bank of America, which typically cap lending at around 50% of appraised fair market value for high-end art collectibles. What distinguishes boutique lenders like Boro from traditional banks isn't just pace, but the financial structure. Drew Watson, managing director and head of art services at Bank of America, describes what is effectively a two-tier market. On one level, are boutique lenders making non-recourse loans, often at higher rates and against a wide array of assets. On another are private banks making recourse loans backed not just by art and other luxury assets, but by the borrower's broader balance sheet. Bank of America's art lending program, which was built out about a decade ago, typically targets collectors with internationally recognized collections valued at $10 million or more. Minimum loan sizes historically start at around $5 million, and loan-to-value ratios are generally capped at about 50% of appraised market value. The two segments are fairly distinct, Watson says. The bank typically lends to borrowers with very large balance sheets and diversified collections. Boutique lenders, by contrast, often serve smaller borrowers, those for whom a recourse loan would not be an option. Luxury asset lending remains a rarefied niche compared with the vast private banking system. But as resale markets deepen and alternative assets proliferate, high-end possessions are increasingly treated not just as status symbols, but as a balance sheet tool. In a market where timing can matter as much as valuation, a Rolex, a Birkin, or a museum-worthy painting is no longer just an indulgence. It can also be dry powder for the next opportunity. Now we're going back to the airline industry. This from Fortune magazine, written by Jacqueline Muniz, dated April 20th. Spirit Airlines looked like it was in the clear, re-emerging from bankruptcy, but rising fuel costs threaten its existence. Spirit Airlines' emergence out of its second bankruptcy in as many years is under pressure as jet fuel prices soar. On February 24th, just days before the war in Iran began, Spirit announced that it expected to exit Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the late spring or early summer, after striking a deal with its lenders and secured creditors. Since then, the war has severely limited tanker traffic in the Strait of Hormuz, spiking oil and jet prices, which has reverberated through the airline industry and, rumor has it, jeopardizing Spirit's tenuous finances. The situation has gotten so dire that the airline has asked the Trump administration for hundreds of millions of dollars in emergency funding, the Air Current reported. A Spirit spokesperson told Fortune the company does not comment on market rumors and speculation, and that operations were continuing as normal. Spirit's restructuring plan hinged on much lower fuel prices. The airline is planning to spend $2.24 per gallon in 2026 and $2.14 a gallon in 2027, according to a March filing to the Securities and Exchange Commission. As of April 16th, jet fuel cost $4.32 a gallon, almost double the estimate. Earlier this month, J.P. Morgan estimated that if fuel stayed at $4.60 a gallon this year, its price in late March, Spirit's forecast operating margin for fiscal year 2026 could deteriorate to about -20% from the 0.5% margin proposed in the company's restructuring plans. This could add $360 million to the company's expenses for the fiscal year, which is more than its cash balance at the end of fiscal year 2025, according to the bank. There are reports that the airline was at risk of liquidation, though the company is not expected to liquidate this week and is shaking all the trees to raise cash, Reuters reported. Spirit is working its way out of its second bankruptcy since November 2024. In the restructuring agreement announced in late February, the company said they'll reduce off-peak flying and adjust seasonal demand. The company expected to reduce its debt and lease obligations from $7.4 billion pre-bankruptcy to about $2.1 billion post-emergence. Spirit is far from the only airline feeling the pinch of the war in Iran. In mid-March, Delta CEO Ed Bastian said the conflict has increased the airline's operating costs by about $400 million. United CEO said if jet fuel prices stay at twice their pre-war costs, it would cost the airline an additional $11 billion in annual costs. Nearly all major U.S. airlines, including American, United, Delta, Southwest, and JetBlue, have raised checked bagged fees to try to offset increased costs. It will take months for jet fuel prices to return to pre-war levels, the head of the International Air Transport Association, representing global airlines, warned earlier this month. Here's our last article of the day, and we may not have time to get through all of this. From Fortune magazine, written by Alexei Oreskovich, dated April 30th. Google Cloud revenue is now 18% of Alphabet's business. Is this the beginning of the end of Google's search identity? Ever since Google was founded in 1998, search has been the core of the company's identity. For much of that time, search has also been the engine, no pun intended, driving Google's business. On Wednesday, that began to change. The company's cloud computing business was the undisputed star of parent company Alphabet's first quarter earnings, posting an eye-popping 63% revenue growth from the prior year, for a total of $20 billion. AI, of course, is what's driving the boom growth in Google's cloud business, as CEO Sundar Pichai and other company executives noted on the earnings call, and investors were delighted, sending shares of Alphabet up 7% in after-hours trading. But lost in the excitement of the moment is something more fundamental. Google Cloud now represents 18% of the company's overall business. It's perhaps just one quarter or two more quarters away from making up one-fifth of the Google empire, something that would have been unthinkable a few years ago. At this time last year, Google represented 13.6% of Alphabet's total revenue. In the first quarter of 2024, cloud was just 11.8%. Advertising has always been the center of gravity for Google, with its high margin and recession-proof ads at the top of a mountain that included YouTube video ads, display ads that Google distributes to other sites, and ads that appear in Google's portfolio of popular properties like Gmail and Maps. It's not that Google's ad business is in any danger of going away. Ads generated $77 billion in the first 3 months of the year, up roughly 16% year over year. That's more revenue than American Express generated in all of 2025. And many Google watchers believe that AI will only enhance the company's capacity to serve ads to searchers. But the cloud business has reached an inflection point where it's no longer just a cute sideshow. In addition to the revenue growth, Google Cloud's operating income tripled from the year-ago period to $6.6 billion. More impressive still, the cloud business operating margin expanded from 9.4% a year ago to 32.9% in Q1. The blooming of this cloud business is likely to have a significant impact at Google beyond the income statement. The cloud business is run by enterprise salespeople in suits like cloud boss Thomas Kurian, an Oracle veteran. It's a completely different culture than the rest of Google, where sandal-wearing engineers, product managers, and media types set the tone. How that cultural contrast plays out inside the company in the quarters and years ahead will be fascinating to watch, especially when the time comes to choose a successor to Pichai. Of course, the main factor that will determine how big the cloud business becomes is AI. Right now, customer demand for AI is insatiable. Google Cloud's current backlog is $460 billion, and Google's cloud business is rising along with it. If the AI train suddenly comes to a halt, or even slows, which many observers think could happen, Google's cloud business could find itself back in second class. Folks, with that, we're done. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program has been Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11.